The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Well, good afternoon. It's Tuesday, and this is the Bill Buckmaster Show on AM 1030, trusted local news and talk. And this is Shelley Fishman. It's not Bill Buckmaster. Bill is off island hopping in the Caribbean with his spouse, and they'll be back next week. But this week, I have a special treat for us. Last week, we did a music show and had a great deal of fun with that. And I would again like to thank James Reel for being my guest. Today, we have a little different kind of orientation. We're gonna talk about government. We're gonna talk about the things that are making government come together and the things that are pulling government apart. And my special guest today is Dr. Brent Millward. Dr. Millward is the director of the School of Government and Public Policy here at the U of A. And he's been on the show before. And when he was on, I was so impressed. I said to Bill, when I sit in for you, I need to have Dr. Millward on the show. And here he is. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show.
Thank you so much, Shelley.
Dr. Millward, what I'd like to do is take us back about 7,000 years. And I don't know if it's exactly 7,000, but about 7,000 years, and talk about, why do we have government? How did government get started? What do we need government for?
Well, no one living today was around 7,000 years ago, and that was before recorded history, too. So we can only surmise. But one of the things an economist who I like very much, Mansur Olson, talks about the start of government as being the trade-off between roving bandits and stationary bandits. That basically you had the Vikings, or at least not 7,000 years ago, but you had bands of brigands going around from place to place, settled community to settled community. And one of the ways in which you protected yourself from them was to hire one of the brigands to stay with you and to protect you from other marauders. And so that's the theory, at least, of how government started. Stationary bandits versus roving bandits.
Okay, so you hired them. You put a contract on the table and said, in return for protecting me, I will give you my loyalty, my money, my what else?
Well, at that time it was, we'll give you some of whatever we have, whether it's cattle or whether it's a grain or whatever, or maybe I'll work for you and build pyramids.
Or fight in your army,
exactly right.
So that's a contract between the governed and the governors.
Right. It's an implicit contract.
An implicit contract. It became more specified and more formal. Back in undergraduate school, I think I learned that the first one of those was probably in England with the went brain dead, where the nobles made a contract with the king to limit the king's power somewhat. But it was written down. We knew what that deal was.
Well, I think you're talking about Magna Carta.
Exactly.
But even before that, one of the things that happened when people first started settling down into agriculture and using agriculture as a way to get out of hunting and gathering, one of the things they did was to sort of invest whoever was leading them with magical powers. Now, who knows how this happened? Who knows how priests came to explain this to people? But this is where you get kings. This is where you get rulers of all kinds who are hereditary, and sort of they embody the state. And you have subjects instead of citizens.
And interesting, and you can find differences around the world, but as cultures kind of evolved and became more and more defined, that model became more or less the common model around the world.
It did. There are also ways in which it was upset. I mean, this was not sort of an even trajectory. The Vikings are a really good example. I was on a cruise on the Norwegian fjords a couple of years ago, and we had...
I was there 2 weeks ago.
And one of the lecturers we had on the Vikings, they said, well, you know, the Vikings really weren't... They weren't a group of people. It was a job title. These are people who wanted to rape and pillage, and they were in a place where you couldn't really have much of a living. They were really strong fighters, and so what they did is they went all over... they went over much of Europe, taking whatever they wanted. And in fact, this allowed governments or created the impetus for governments to become stronger to defend themselves against them. Or in some places, they actually hired the Vikings to govern them.
Right. So there was an implied contract between the governed and those who were hired or selected to be the forms of government that would provide the protection in return for something that was given up by the populace. And
correct.
One of those things that's given up is money or the equivalent of value. Another thing is a certain amount of personal freedom that can get given up. So let's take this historical perspective and bring it a little bit closer to home, and let's take a look at the intellectual revolution in the 17th century, or the Age of Reason, and talk just a tiny bit about how this became to be formalized and articulated in the words of Rousseau, Hobbes, Locke, etc., all of those people that we were burdened with in undergraduate history, reading all of that paperwork.
Either that or reading the Cliff's Notes version
of
it, which sort of dates me. But let's take a look at that in the context of the American Revolution.
Sure.
Because this is the first new nation. The United States is the first new nation on the earth, and it was set up in a way that was the highest ideals of the Enlightenment. We can sort of forget about slavery here. But in terms of the kinds of social thinkers and philosophers you're talking about, they were writing this into the Constitution as they understood it.
And so all of this formalized intellectual work that was being done in Europe somehow got put into the documents that formed this country.
Right. That's exactly right.
So the idea that governments are formed by men for certain specific purposes to
correct.
Guarantee... life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and you know, those kinds of things, that came right out of the social contract thinking at the end of the 17th century.
I'm not a philosopher, but to my best knowledge, I think that's pretty much the case.
Okay, so we've got a government that has a set of expectations and a set of people who deliver on those expectations, and so we come to today's modern day as we work through history very, very quickly. And what we see is that there appears to be some balance problem between expectations and capabilities.
Certainly today that's the case.
And that creates unhappiness in both parties. And a struggle, if you will, to figure out how to deal with those things. Can you talk a little bit about what we're seeing in the modern world today, and you know, as recently as this Thursday, there'll be an election in Europe. So, and it's scheduled not to go very well for the so-called liberal democracy faction of the European Union. So, tell us about that.
Well, let me start. I'm not going to go as far as you went, but I'm going to start with the revolutionary bargain.
Okay.
And that is, as a revolutionary people, Americans have always been of two minds about government. On the one hand, we can all recognize the get the government off my back, or the joke, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I'm here from the federal government and here to help you. But on the other hand, as soon as something goes wrong, one of the refrains we almost always hear is, there ought to be a law.
Right.
And so... we are, as a people, I think we are absolutely of two minds about government.
Was that unique to America, do you think? Or is that something that we see throughout history and certainly in the current world?
I think that's debatable, but I think that we see it in its pure form here in the United States more than anywhere else.
Wow.
I really do. I think one of the things that we know is that people don't like government at all, but one of the things that they really, really like are government services. And so one of the things that people who, conservatives who want to cut the size of government have run into time after time is that while on the one hand, citizens may vote for them because they think they don't like government or they don't like what government does or they don't like what government does for some people, they really like things like Social Security, they really like Medicare, and they like other things that government provides.
Right. So if you're in government and you have a genetic disorder that says, I need to stay in power,
right,
you're going to find ways to bring that dichotomy, that ambivalence about government into a more kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, into more balance in people's minds and their perceptions, at least. And what are some of the ways that government has found to do that?
Well, I think one of the ways government has found to do that is in a democracy like we have in the United States, you find ways to compromise.
Uh-huh.
So that when government works well, it's typically not one-party government. It's when you find people going across the aisle and working with the other party to give them some of what they want, and in return, they get some of what they want. And that's something that's sadly lacking today. When you have only one faction, in many cases, what you're talking about is less than 50% of the people who voted in the case of the most recent election here in the United States, while Hillary Clinton won the popular vote and Donald Trump won the Electoral College. So you actually had more people voting for her than for him. Now, you can argue that either way. We have the college, and it's not going away, and that's the way presidents are elected. But you don't find large numbers of people on one side and only a few on the other. So I would argue that one of the things you've got to do today is to figure out ways to compromise.
And I'm extrapolating from what you're saying,
sure.
But what you're saying is that that contract, that compact that we have between the people and the governed and the governors has to constantly be renewed.
I think that's the case, but I think there's another contract, and that is when you agree to work in the context of a democracy, what you have to do is to view your opponents as legitimate. Whether you hate their ideas, they're there because many people in the country voted for them and sent them to Congress or put them in the White House or put them in the governor's mansion. And if you can't accept their legitimacy, it makes democratic government very problematic. And we'll go into this with some of our discussion today that you and I've talked about illiberal democracies.
Right. So this is a great time to take a break. And before we take a break, what I'd like to do is remind our listeners that the Buckmaster Live Line is open. The number to call in is 790-2040-790-2040. And Bob Dio, who's doing a great job producing and engineering the show, will take your name down and write down your question, flash it on the screen, and we'll deal with those discussion points as they come up. So for now, we're going to take a break, and I am obliged to pay the bills here, keep the lights on. And one way to do that is to note that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Exciting news from Mona's. Mona's is now serving made-to-order hot breakfasts. Mona's is open for lunch and breakfast right now. Lunch right now, breakfast earlier today. If you decide you absolutely have to go to Mona's right now, then please turn on the radio in your car and continue to listen to us. Mona's Danish Bakery, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Go to monasdanishbakery.com or buckmastershow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. The Regional Transportation Authority has a 35-member Citizens Advisory Committee working to identify transportation priorities for the region and will be seeking public input on those priorities before too long. These priorities will help guide development of an RTA continuation plan. The current RTA plan and half-cent excise tax will continue through June 2026. To learn more, please visit rtamobility.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I'm passionate about travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. And when I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport. With 9 airlines flying nonstop to 22 destinations and easy one-stop connections, I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient with competitive airfares, and there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com.
Hey, it's Matt Russell from The Buckmaster Show.
And this is Ryan Hansen from Bon Voyage Travel.
I am so pumped to be partnering with Bon Voyage on my next culinary and cocktail cruise.
This is definitely a cruise for foodies as you experience the Mediterranean on Celebrity Cruises.
And the private excursions that your team has arranged for us? I mean, come on, an ouzo distillery tour in Greece? A food and wine day on Malta?
We'll handle everything, so all you and your guests need to do is eat, drink, and be happy.
Go to bvtravel.com/Matt Russell to learn more.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
And we're back live. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster here on the Buckmaster Show. And I am honored to have with us in the studio Professor Brent Millward from the U of A. And we're talking about, the things that make government work and the things that maybe get in the way of government working. And we kind of went historically and traced back a little bit the origins of government, the reasons for government, and the things that can make government feel uncomfortable for people. And so I think what we would agree about is that the balance between what the government wants and what the populace wants is something that always has to be kept in balance. In fact, it has to be. We have to be aware of that. Government, in order to stay in power, has to be aware of that. And so there's this ambivalence between, as you mentioned, Professor, about we hate government, but we want it there when we think we need it to be there. So there are some ways that governments have found to smudge over, if you will, the perception that government's always there, but at the same time provide the services.
Well, exactly. This is what I call the hollow state. And I've worked on this for the last 25 years or so. And you find it everywhere. And a good example here in Pima County is mental health care, indigent mental health care. We spend about $300 million a year on it. And I could walk around Pima County for the next month and never bump into one employee of government who delivers that. It's all delivered through the nonprofit or through the private sector. The last government official who touches any of that money is in Phoenix, and that's the person who writes the check for the master contract for the private firm that controls this.
So we're getting the service. We may not be getting as much of it as we want.
Right.
We may be getting too much, but we're getting the service, but we don't immediately identify the providers of that service as being our tax,
it's coming from our tax
taxes.
Dollars, right.
It's coming from our tax dollars,
right.
But we don't identify it that way. And we don't see the people providing it as being government employees.
That is exactly right.
And that's not just for mental health services. I assume that that goes on.
To give you an idea, let's move from the services themselves, which we'll talk about, but let's also talk about the number of employees. Now, if I asked your listeners, has the size of the federal government in terms of number of employees gone up over the last 50 years, my guess is 99.9% would say absolutely. But that's just not the case. If you look at the number of government employees, we have the same number today that we had in 1952 during Eisenhower's administration.
But we're getting so much more, aren't we?
We are. We're getting much, much more. Or we're spending, depending on your perspective, we're either getting more or spending a heck of a lot more. No question
about
that.
Okay, that's magic. How does that magic work?
Well, the magic is the hollow state. And that is we use the nonprofit sector, we use the private sector to produce, to deliver, and even to evaluate and oversee the effectiveness of those tax dollars that are spent by third parties.
So I'm sensing that this isn't all a good thing, that in moving or outsourcing the functions of government, the functions of that social contract, and by disguising them somehow as being not by the government, we could overshoot the mark and begin to actually destroy the things in government that are working well and that are best provided by or controlled by government.
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, that is certainly a reasonable argument, because one of the things we argue about all the time, what are the essential things that are produced by government?
Sure.
National defense is clearly one of these. Well, in Afghanistan and Iraq at various times, we had more contractors on the ground, boots on the ground, than we had our own forces. And so you start to wonder whether or not this is the kind of situation where we can control the actions of these people as well as we can when you have people who are completely under a hierarchy headed by a general.
So one of the problems in doing this outsourcing is that we can't control the outcomes. In fact, we might not even be able to control necessarily the direction of how it kind of works.
Well, you can. People can write contracts effectively, and contracts are written effectively all the time. But to do that, you need enough people with enough skill to be able to write those contracts and enough people overseeing those contracts to intervene if you're starting to exceed the mark or you're not doing well enough.
So that government becomes kind of the police cop, the cop on the beat that says you're doing a good job for us or you're not doing a good job for us, or maybe we didn't do a good job of writing the contract, we need to change that contract,
right.
Whatever. But in any case, this is taxpayer money
Absolutely.
Being used to provide government services
to citizens
in a way that is intended to make citizens feel good about their lives and good about the fact that the contract they have with the government to be governed is working for them.
But here's the rub. If they don't identify those services with government, then you start to get things out of balance, just as we talked about.
Aha. So when things are getting out of balance, I suppose there's at least two things that can drive that to a point of disruption. One of those things is we're just doing a terrible job, or we might be doing a terrible job of monitoring the contracts, of making sure the people that we've elected or selected to do that work for us do it properly. But then there's this whole environment going on that keeps changing throughout history.
Exactly.
And changing at an accelerated rate. So there are some trends now that are taxing the balance.
Well, one of the trends that's taxing the balance is the size of the contractor workforce. And that is, if there are only 2 million federal employees, there are 5 million people who are working under contract.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty hard to oversee a situation like that. You have 2% of the federal government employees overseeing 20% of the federal budget. The federal budget right this year is about $4.4 trillion, and that would be in the area of healthcare.
Okay. But aren't there some other things that are just changing the world that we live in that are making things harder and harder to react to in a way that people and the government will feel comfortable that what the government is doing is modern and up to date and keeping in mind that different generations have different priorities. I mean, I'm getting a little bit crazy here with with how complex this is. But clearly, we don't have telegraph anymore. We don't have facsimile too much anymore. The technology has changed and everything has become faster. And our demands for that have become faster.
I think that's certainly true. And there are clearly those kinds of technological changes that are making it very hard to govern. Very hard to run elections because there are ways in which you can use that information technology that was going to free us just a few years ago to control the behavior of people, or at least not control the behavior, but influence the behavior of people who will be voting.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a break and keep that in mind, because I'd like to come back and really kind of, peel back the onion around that in our next segment. I remind listeners that the live line is open at 790-2040. I am with Professor Brent Millward from the U of A. We're talking about a subject that is kind of on everybody's mind, which is government working? And if it's not working, what can we do to fix it? Is it working for me? Is it working for you? If it's not, then gosh, we've got to do something about it. But before we take a break, again, I would remind everybody that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Silver City in Grand County, New Mexico, just 3 hours east of Tucson. So much to do in Silver City in Grand County, New Mexico, like exploring historic downtown Silver City or visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. You know, for a complete listing of the many things to do and the great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. We'll take a break and be back with Dr. Millward.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
Let's say you need an honest roofer. Where do you start? Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona has more than 3,200 accredited businesses ready to help and committed to doing things right. Next time you need a trusted mechanic, plumber, AC company, or florist, go to our website, bbb.org, or call us at 520-888-6161. Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona. We are here to help you find local companies you can trust.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Television work with them? Yeah. Well, we're back. This is Shelley Fishman live, sitting in for Bill Buckmaster with Dr. Brent Millward from the U of A. We're talking about government. We're talking about the history of government. Now we're going to spend the second half of the show getting into the issues that are really affecting us every day. You can't turn on the television without hearing about some level of dissatisfaction or politics or the things that are driving the news every day. Dr. Millward, what are the trends today that are making it so hard to keep the balance going between governments and the people who are being governed?
Well, this is a relatively long list. I think one of the things that we've seen in the last 20, 30 years is economic power worldwide is exceeding political power. Certainly true in North America and Western Europe. The state is not strong enough to control the market. Very often, what you'll see is if a company threatens to leave, they get what they want politically. And that may not be good for citizens in terms of wages. And then you've got all kinds of other trends as well. Whatever you think about climate change is changing everything. I do a lot of work with intelligence services and security services around the world. And one of the things that you listen to these folks talk when I'm invited to give a lecture there, they'll talk about the fact that terrorism is not an existential threat. It's basically a manageable threat. And we've managed it reasonably well here in the United States since 9/11. But on the other hand, if you look at climate change and the effects it's having, if you're looking on migration, where people are moving all over the world and all around the world, not just across our southern border, because where they're living is just not habitable anymore. And so we've got 50 million people who are migrating around the world today that are not in the countries where they were born. That's right. The highest since World War II, 1945.
So that's causing kind of dislocations
right.
on a massive scale.
Yep.
But you also have, because of climate change, an economic impact that is completely off budget.
Completely off budget. That's exactly right. It's
right.
a crisis.
So it's a crisis. So that if you can react to each individual flood that or hurricane or tornado that occurs, and they're occurring as we speak now in
right.
the Midwest with greater frequency and greater intensity. You can begin to build infrastructure that protects the citizens somewhat from those effects, as they've done in the Netherlands for hundreds of years, but as we're now thinking about doing in cities up and down the coast of Florida, New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, et cetera, you've got to protect these places and you got to pay for that protection.
And that has to come from tax dollars.
Exactly.
So you've got that. And then the next thing you have is what I call the make-nothing economy. You have companies that have unbelievable evaluations in the market, Uber, Facebook, Amazon, Airbnb. They're magnificent companies in many ways. But what makes them different than the Fords, the General Motors, the U.S. Steels of a different generation is they don't employ many people. That they are basically hiring people under contract. In many ways, this is the hollow state taken to the corporate level. So now you have these hollow corporations that are operating very much the same way government is.
So if I'm understanding you, there are two things going on there.
Yeah.
One is they are outsourcing a lot of the labor that they may need to produce the products and services that they're producing.
Exactly.
But in addition, because of technology, they need less anyway to produce a dollar of revenue. They need fewer people to produce a dollar of revenue.
That's exactly right.
So two things working against the average guy who showers after coming home from work.
that indeed is the case. The gig economy is not necessarily a great economy to build a strong, vibrant middle class. And that's one of the things that in the United States is really worrisome to me, because the bargain, we've talked about these compacts, and the social bargain is that I work hard and I have a chance so that my kids are going to do better than I did. And what we're seeing today is many people like me are worrying their kids are not going to do as well as they've done, because they're coming into a different kind of economy with a different economic structure, with a different set of opportunities, with a different set of threats than we had.
Would you say that that effect, that dissatisfaction among individuals has become more concentrated over the past 30 or 40 years?
I think it has. And I think if you take a look around the world, particularly what I call sort of populist illiberal democracies, and if you know, we can name a number
of
them.
Sure.
Let's do that. So let's look at Hungary. Viktor Orban just met with President Trump in the White House a few days ago. Viktor Orban keeps the illusion of a democracy, but the institutions of government are controlled, the press is constrained. A million Hungarians out of a population of 11 million have left the country. Universities have been closed. And these are the kinds of things, the same thing you see in Turkey with Erdogan. And if you look at Maduro's Venezuela, the same kinds of things. They keep elections, but they're so controlled that the ruling party can almost never lose.
So there's an attempt on the part of autocrats.
Right.
Or let's say democratically elected autocrats. Democrats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Democratic autocrats. How
democratic
about that?
Democratic autocrats. There you go. to maintain an illusion that the contract is still in balance.
Right.
But the only way they can keep people from rebelling against their, or in favor of their own dissatisfaction and disillusionment is by, in fact, becoming more and more powerful.
Exactly. Now, the other thing is there are lots of countries that are still clearly democracies, but that have real problems. I mean, we have that in our country.
Sure.
With people who feel like the economy, the government has not treated them well. They don't have the kinds of jobs they wanted. We certainly see this in France with the Yellow Vest movement. And in many other countries as well, the Brexiteers in Great Britain. And you've got a lot of angry people around the world. And many of them are angry. I mean, I don't blame them for being angry at all. If I were in those circumstances, I'd be angry too. Many of them are from areas that have been left behind. They're formerly industrial areas that now are sort of hollowed out. And people are thriving in the big cities who are engaged in finance capital and engaged in high-level services to an affluent population. But people out in the Rust Belt, or the equivalent of the Rust Belt in France or Germany, are not feeling so good. Certainly in the case of East Germany, you take a look at people who grew up under communism. And then after the merger of the two countries, after the wall came down, found that they had a skill set that ill-equipped them for the modern world. If they wanted to be a communist bureaucrat, it was great. But if they wanted to form their own company or be an entrepreneur, this was a skill set they didn't have, and they probably were too old to do it. So these are the kinds of people that have adopted very populist ideologies. They've supported populists around the world. And one of the reasons for that is government hasn't found a way to effectively bring these people into this new world.
But aren't those governments trying to deal with that dissatisfaction by making promises that ultimately they can't keep?
Well, I guess time will tell.
Time will tell, exactly. But the effort on the part of governments to adapt to all of these forces that are upsetting the balance. We see some adaptations. We see the democratic socialist model in Europe, which is now under under, you know, severe pressure. But that model, which created a much more substantial safety net for people than we felt the need to do here in this country, now even that is being seen as insufficient. We see what, for instance, state capitalist models do in China, or gosh, whatever you call what the Russians are doing, which is kind of mob rule on the economic side of things, as ways of kind of holding the populace down. It's kind of, we'll, you know, let them eat cake, but we'll provide some cake.
Well, I think every country figures out a different balance, and you've outlined a number of them. You know, democratic socialism, the European model, and this is what we think of as sort of the Nordic model. This is Norway, Sweden, Denmark, maybe Finland.
Sure.
And what they've done is they spend an awful lot of money, the taxpayers' money, to provide a very robust safety net. But even they are moving more toward the market. They, to become more competitive in a world market that they are very small players in, they've had to adapt.
Sure.
And so
sure.
The social safety net in some of these countries has shrunk. Probably the one it shrunk the most was Sweden. And this brings us to another very uncomfortable truth. And that is, one of the reasons these countries could provide for their citizens is all of those citizens, by and large, tended to look alike. They were from the same ethnic stock. And in Sweden, one of the areas of dissatisfaction is they have taken in a lot of refugees, particularly refugees from the Middle East, from Africa. And that is causing some Swedish taxpayers who are Swedish, historically Swedish, to say, you know, do I really want to spend my money on those people who have greater needs than other Swedes?
Because it's impossible to hide the fact that some people are getting more services than other people because they need to get those services.
If you're a refugee who's just come in, you do.
You do, absolutely.
You do.
So we're going to take a break. Dr. Brent Millward is with us. I'm Shelley Fishman, sitting in for the vacationing Bill Buckmaster. A couple of weeks ago and a couple of years ago for you, Brent, you were kind of doing the fjords in Scandinavia and enjoying the food that is provided by Scandinavians. And one of those foods, especially in Denmark, are pastries. And, you know, Mona's Danish Pastries is doing this every day, and they're doing it here in Tucson. So if you can, if you have a yen for some really great sweets or even some really great baked bread, by all means, hightail it down to the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Go to Mona's Danish Bakery and feast on Scandinavian goodness.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Travel smart and fly Tucson. Check out flytucson.com. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year transportation plan is funded through June 2026 by a special taxing district, which is a state-established political subdivision within Pima County. The RTA plan and half-cent excise tax were voter-approved in May 2006, and the tax is collected within the district. More about RTA Citizens Advisory Committee's efforts to develop an RTA continuation plan at rtamobility.com.
Every day, your safety and freedom is protected by the service and sacrifice of our first responders and military. Please join us in this community effort to build the Southern Arizona Veterans and First Responders Living Memorial. a place to celebrate those who have paid the price for our freedom and those who continue to defend it today. Help create a space where these memories, past, present, and future, will live forever. Learn more and donate by visiting vfrm.org.
This is Moa Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing.
And this is Bill Buckmaster. For several decades now, Mo has been my go-to expert for all my framing needs and bathroom mirrors. I trust Mo for service, professionalism, and top-of-the-line quality.
Thanks, Bill. Give us a call at 795-8226 and stop by Mo's Gallery and Fine Framing on the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge, right next to Copenhagen, and on the web at mosgallery.com.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year. And if you are over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
And we're back. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster with Dr. Brent Millward, who is the director of the School of Government and Public Policy at the U of A. We're talking about, small subjects like the future of the galaxy. and we've kind of defined it historically. We've now really put some meat around what some of the very intractable problems are that we're trying to solve. And Dr. Millward, now we're going to take a crystal ball and we're going to try to see what's going to happen. I mean, how do we reset the balance? How do we make the idea of governing a populace that is unhappy a reality?
Well, there are a number of options. You can have a revolution.
Well,
if you don't like, Thomas Jefferson talked about the need for a revolution every generation or two. We certainly have seen this around the world. The other thing is to try and admit that what you're doing is not working. You know, the definition of idiocy is to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, and it's not working. So if we're not happy with the way things are working, what we need to do is to figure out what can we do. The United States is an incredibly rich country. It has resources that most countries would die for. It has an incredible—
Or kill for.
It has an incredibly well-trained population. There are certainly plenty of ways we can get ourselves out of this. It's, to me, the question, do we have the will? Now, the other question is the crystal ball. I learned one thing in graduate school. I read a wonderful article called The Future of Futurology. And sadly, the future of futurology is not very enlightening because they looked back at all the crystal ball forecasts and almost all of them were wrong. So let's take what we say here with a grain of salt.
Sure.
But I think that you have to get a political system back in balance. You have to have an agreement between, at least in the United States, the two parties, that the other party is not the devil incarnate, that there are things that the other party is saying that have merit and you should listen to them, and that even if you don't think there's very much, see if you can find a way in which you can work across the aisle, at least on things like passing a budget, which we haven't been able to do in a very long time. That's one thing. The other thing, what are the great challenges facing us? Climate change is one of them. There's no question about that. Migration, what are you going to do about that worldwide? It's not just a question of the southern border.
Right. So every time we come back to thinking about this as a U.S. problem,
no.
It is not an American problem. It is a worldwide problem.
It is a worldwide
and
problem.
And the world is so integrated right now, so dependent upon each other, that we really can't think of this in a vacuum. Let's take a quick call. Or not.
Shelley.
Yes.
Hey.
Who's this?
This is Robert.
Hey, Robert.
There's so much pontificating going on and no solutions. It's just getting under my craw.
And you too.
This is the greatest country on earth. There's no two ways about it. But if I had to compare this little immature fighting between both parties, I'd have to be comparing them to the Sunni and the Shia. So to that extent, we're no better than them. They're fighting over one sentence in the Quran and can't get anything together.
So I think what you're saying, Robert, is that this ain't easy.
It's not possible.
Oh, it has to be possible. The alternative is devastation.
Well, that does come and go.
That does come and go. Thank you for your comments, Thank Robert. You. I really do appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit about that, Dr. Millward. If you would, devastation, I mean, when it doesn't work, when American industry 20 years or worldwide industry 20 years from now needs 3 billion people and there's 10 on the planet.
Well, I think that is a huge problem, the problem of robotics. I mean, one of the ways we talked about this back in the 50s, it was going to be terrific.
Yep.
Because what it was going to do was free us up to play golf and to enjoy life with our families and to take more vacations. We find out that that's not the way things are working out. I'm still fairly optimistic about what automation can and can't do, and I think how that works out is probably the topic of another discussion
sure.
we have. But I think there are solutions. Actually, Robert, I think, had a very good one, is if we've got two parties that are arguing over the equivalent of the meaning of one sentence in the Quran, they need to get a grip. And they need to look at what's good for the country as a whole and for the citizens as a whole and figure out ways to deal with the very real problems that we face. Trade is a problem.
But that particular issue between two groups of people has been going on for nearly a millennium.
Well, but it's worked better at some times than worse. There is no solution. We're dealing with dilemmas. People have very different views. There are sort of, I don't know if people come out of the womb as conservatives and liberals, but maybe that's the case. But there are things that they can agree on. And we have done this when we have great challenges before World War II, the Depression, how to deal with the post-war world. We created things like the GI Bill, which is one of the great social programs in history, that brought millions of Americans who'd been fighting into colleges and universities and created the best university system in the world.
Well, and maybe getting more people involved out of their communities, something like national service, which will get people into a position where they can relate to each other a little better.
That's clearly one of the benefits of things like the draft.
Because the things you cited as times when we got it right were when the crises became so extreme we had no choice but to get it right. Are we there?
I don't know if we're there or not. I mean, we're either there or we're 1859, right before the Civil War. I think those are two things we need to think about. That was another time when things were settled in a very, very different way.
Here in this country.
In this country, right.
Now, they were 20 years away in Europe from having the same kinds of issues.
Right.
So you can kind of take a look at that chunk of history in time and say there were violent ways that these issues were resolved.
But I think there are nonviolent ways, and I certainly hope that's what we have, and I hope we have an increase in civil discourse and a serious interest in wanting to solve the kinds of problems we've been talking about here today.
I am so glad that we are ending this discussion on a more optimistic note, because it could be that we didn't. And I thank you. I thank you for your wisdom. I thank you for bringing these things to the listening audience. This is Shelley Fishman, and I'm sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, very appreciative of the time. I'm with Dr. Brent Millward from the U of A, and we really do appreciate the time that you've given us as listeners.